For 20 years, Small Business Digest has helped millions of entrepreneurs grow their business. We do this by highlighting ways they can increase profits. Whether these suggestions improve marketing and provide better financial management, offer robust people management ideas, provide speedier logistics, our guests each offer ways of reducing costs, adding sales, widening profits. This is Don Mazzella. We have Jeff O'Hara with us today. He's a long list of interesting guests. Jeff, welcome to the program. Jeff, tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I started out my career in the hotel business, and in 1997 switched over to start a series of companies, both in small hotels and also in the business event space. And in the course of the last 22 years now, I've started 10 different companies in the hospitality industry, and everything from small bed and breakfast to medium-sized hotels and business events and website companies. My company, primary company now, is called PRA Business Events. We're a franchise of a national company that's got 26 offices across the USA, and we specialize in doing events for corporate meetings and incentive travel programs that are coming into New Orleans.
That's really interesting. I have a lot of questions, but I think the main one is, and why you hear about, is recovery. What happens when things go awry? Am I correct on that?
Recovery. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Yeah, I've been a business owner in the hospitality industry for through three major events: 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, and then the Great Recession. Each time, we basically were shut down. We went out. We were lost all of our business in each of those three events, and I had to, come up with ways to ensure that we could be successful in the long run, even withstanding that. So I think that, brings a kind of a unique perspective on how to start a business, because we're basically startups three times over every time this happened.
My question is, I've been there, or you've been, but what are some of the things that you've learned from coming back from these disasters that you'd like to pass on to others?
Well, the biggest thing I think that led to our ultimate success was, the relationships that were built even prior to when these disasters happened, because you've got relationships in every business, whether it's with your clients or your customers, with your suppliers, and you've got to have a high level of trust, because especially in our industry where it's a service business, we don't have necessarily a physical product. So if you've got good, trusting relationships with your customers and with the people on the other end, your suppliers, then when the chips are down and you give them your word that something's going to happen, they're more willing to buy into what it is that you're trying to accomplish. So if you've got a client that's hesitant to come to New Orleans because they've heard, that it's not fully recovered from Katrina, for example, and I give them, specific examples of things that they can do that I know that are going to work well for what their objectives are, if I've got a pre-existing trusting relationship with them, then, they're more likely to buy into what we're trying to sell them and get them back in the business of coming to New Orleans. On the other side of that, we've got a lot of suppliers, and just like every other fast-growing company, a lot of times, you've got people that you owe money to. And when after Katrina, after 9/11, and during the recession, I called the owner of every company that we owed money to and gave them my word that they were going to get paid, and gave them a timeline when it would happen, and they trusted that that was going to be the case, and we were able to continue those supplier relationships as on that basis. So those are kind of two examples of how the relationships really become important when you got your back against the wall a little bit.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. But let's bring that to a broader question. It seems to me that building up trust with your suppliers and with your guests is a real key. But a lot of companies seem to have forgotten that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I agree with that, and I think that, you know, one of the funniest parts about that is that it's so easy to build good relationships with people. I mean, I used my suppliers as an example. A lot of businesses treat their suppliers like second class citizens, and, you know, just make them try to, you know, squeeze them on price and everything and all that sort of thing, where we try to be really fair with everybody and make sure that everybody in the supply chain can be profitable. And I just think that, you know, it's so funny that so many people don't think that way, and it makes it real easy to differentiate ourselves on something that doesn't cost any money to do as a business owner. You just treat people fairly. It doesn't cost me a dime to do that. But so many companies don't do it, and it makes it so easy to me to be different.
You know, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, another thing that seems to be happening is that we don't seem to honor our agreements, and in this world today, we seem not to.
I know, and it's, you know, it's just, you know, in my view, the way I was raised and the way that I operate, it's just so easy to do the right thing all the time. You don't have to think twice about it if you're always doing what's the right thing and what's the right thing for your partners. But, you know, a lot of people in this world today, whether it's business owners or politicians, don't seem to feel that way. But again, I guess that it's something that's so easy to do, and it can make you stand out for doing things the right way.
You do events, and I just saw something that with the government shutdown, a lot of events are losing portions of their attendees. Are you seeing that in your business?
No, we don't. You know, from our standpoint, we don't do government business, so it really hasn't impacted us. You know, I think that if it went on for, you know, 6 months or something like that, some of our clients that do some government business would be impacted by it. But at this stage of the game, it hasn't done anything to us.
Well, what kind of events do you do, and what are some of the issues that you face in doing those events?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of the times when we're doing larger events, you know, when we've got conventions in town that might have 20 or 30,000 people and we're doing events for them, or when we've got, you know, clients that are doing very secretive things, like, you know, when they're doing product launches and things like that, security and safety is always a thing that's top of mind in our industry, because our clients are operating in a space that they don't usually work in, coming to a new city or coming to a venue where we're doing a big party for them, and they leave it, you know, they leave that in our hands to ensure that whether it's, you know, a competitor can't sneak into the general session where they're launching a new product, or whether it's a, you know, a guy carrying a bomb can't sneak into their big gala evening dinner, you know, at an offsite venue. Those are a couple of, you know, safety and security are things that are really a very high priority for everybody in this current environment that, you know, that we're sort of living in. But then the other side too is the making everybody that's attending each of these events, no matter how big they are, feel special and make them feel like it's all about them. I mean, we live now, you know, in an era of Instagram and everything where everybody wants to be showing off what they're doing. So if we create really special events that they can turn around and show off to all their friends on their social media feeds, then that's way more important. I was in a meeting the other day where somebody was referring to the new status symbol, whereas before people would have, you know, a BMW car or a certain purse or whatever that was their status symbol. Now it's, you know, where they took their pictures of, what's on their Instagram feed of doing things that are very unique that everybody else can't do. So that's our job, is to put them in positions to where they can, you know, brag through their social media and show everybody what their status symbol is by having a very unique event here in New Orleans.
We're talking with Jeff O'Hara. Jeff, your website?
Website is www.NOLA Meetings, NOLA Meetings.com. And then also, as you know, I've got a book that was just released, and the website for my book is www.JeffreyO'Hara.com.
Well, tell us about your book.
My book is really set out for entrepreneurs. Everybody that's been on an entrepreneurial journey has had ups and downs and setbacks, and a lot of people gave up as a result of that. And so what I'm trying to show is how, you know, we were able to survive these three major events, 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, the Great Recession, and come back even bigger and stronger and more financially successful than we'd ever been, even in spite of that. And it's a kind of a toolbook for a toolbox for entrepreneurs, not just in overcoming adversity, but in, you know, how to develop those relationships, be it with your clients or your suppliers or your staff, and being able to leverage those relationships to make your company successful. There's also a lot of, you know, personal anecdotes in there, because a lot of the things that have happened to me over the course of my journey have been self-imposed, and they're kind of funny too. And then there's also a little behind the scenes look at New Orleans, because New Orleans is just a very unique city in America, and it's understood and misunderstood. It's got a lot of cast of characters, and so there's a lot of insight into what it's like to run this kind of business in New Orleans. Sure. So the book is called Have Fun, Fight Back, and Keep the Party Going. It's lessons from a New Orleans entrepreneur's journey to the Inc. 5000, and it talks about how we had to come back from the shutdown of business after 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, and the Great Recession, in which three events had basically put us out of business three different times. And every entrepreneur has had ups and downs in their journey, and everybody, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs give up after one of those ups, or one of those downs, I should say. And it talks about how the relationships that we've built over the years helped us have success, and have actually even more success after each of those events, because we're able to take a lot of market share away from competitors that didn't have the foundation built that we had already. And it also has, some of the ups and downs in my life have been self-imposed, and they're pretty funny in some cases. So there's a little bit of humor in there, and how we came back from those things. And it's also kind of a behind-the-scenes look at life in New Orleans, which a lot of people find very interesting, because it's a very unique city in America.
Well, Jeff, let me ask you the first question. People always say, well, why did you write a book? And that's my question. What made you decide to write that book?
Well, you know, there's a couple of reasons. One, because I think that there's certainly things in there that everybody can learn from, whether you're an entrepreneur or in the hospitality business or not. I've had a lot of unique kind of a lot of unique experiences, and frankly, again, some of them are kind of funny. And I also wanted to, you know, not a lot of people in my industry have taken the time to write a book that can be used. It's not just a breezy memoir. There's a lot of business lessons in it, and it gives me an opportunity to kind of stand out in our community as someone that's an expert in what I do. I think as the internet comes along, more and more companies, or especially in the service business, people become a little, get the impression that, you know, people feel that you might be a little commoditized, because anybody can find out information on the internet, and you've really got to stand out and show your expertise. And that was, you know, kind of a driving force between why I decided to do it.
Well, that's very important. Sitting down, it's easy to say I want to write a book, but sitting down and actually doing it is a different thing. I've written a couple of books, and I know how to feel. When you finished it, how did you feel?
How did I feel? Well, you know, it's interesting because when I finished it at first, I felt a great sense of relief. It took me about a year and a half to get to the point where it was ready to publish. And a good bit of that time was kind of going back and forth with editors. And, you know, I've got a kind of a unique voice, and I didn't want it to be brushed down too much. And so I spent a lot of time negotiating with the editors on how exactly I wanted to see things, how exactly I wanted to say things. So it was, at one point, you know, I finished the book. It was a sense of relief that I finally got the project done. It was a sense of excitement because I could now tell my story to the world in a way that a lot of people can't, and nobody really wants to sit down and listen to me talk for 153 pages either. So I get a chance to tell my story to the world, and I'm pretty excited about that. But then on the other hand, then I realized the amount of work that has to go into marketing the book. So when I thought I was done, but I had a lot of work still out of me.
Well, that's, you know, having been in publishing, you first, go ahead. What were you saying?
Can you repeat that? You went dead there under something about publishing.
No, I, having been in publishing as long as I have, I know that now you have to publicize your own book. Are you there, Jeff? We're having some tech troubles, but what I wanted to say basically is you learned the lesson that authors are learning today. You have to publicize your own book. How are you publicizing it?
Yeah, exactly. It's We've done a lot of promoting it on social media, also through my business network, which is very extensive. I mean, for the last 20 years, I've been building up client base, supplier base. So there's a lot of people that have helped me, a lot of influencers, shall you say, that have helped me push that message along. We're doing a big book launch event here locally in 2 weeks at a great local bookstore. Called the Garden District Bookshop in New Orleans. That's on January 24th, by the way, to get a plug in there. But it's all been really grassroots. I've got a PR company that has been sending out, you know, releases and helping me craft some stories that can be used in industry publications to help support the book launch as well.
Well, what are the one or two things that you'd like to pass on from the book that you'd like to pass on to our audience?
You know, I think the at one point, you know, I had to sit back and reflect on really what you know, allowed us to get through all the things, and the things that I found when I self-reflected that really I thought drove the success were three things: persistence, charm, and cojones. And that is that, you know, in any of these things, you've got to be persistent, you've got to keep pressing ahead, and you've got to believe that you can do whatever it is and overcome whatever in front of you. From a charm standpoint, I think that, you know, your relationships with people, the fact that they trust you, those are the things that you build up over time. That doesn't come overnight. But once you say something to somebody, they've got to believe that you can do it, and they've got to like you as well. And so you've got to have a little bit of charm in your personality, and being Irish, that comes pretty naturally. And then, you know, the third one being cojones. I don't know if that's good for radio or not, but the point is that, you know, you can't be scared of anything. Things are going to come in an entrepreneurial journey that come at you from every direction. You got to face up to your demons, and you got to be able to plow ahead without breaking a sweat or letting people see you sweat anyway.
Wow. That's pretty good. But if you had one or two things you'd tell a small business person today, what would they be?
I think that, you know, I look at a lot of new businesses starting up because, you know, I've gotten to the point where we're doing In addition to running my companies, also a lot of investment in startup companies. And I think that a really important thing is that you've got to understand what your product is, and you've got to understand what your market is, and you've got to understand whether people in the market that you're looking at will pay for what you've got. I look at a lot of companies that have people are very wrapped up in the product, and they might have some whiz-bang technology, but they haven't checked to see if the marketplace will pay for it. So I think it's really important to understand who your customers are, and are there enough of them out there to support your company when you're starting up? And that's whether you're developing, you know, some great new technology for Apple Store, or if you're opening a coffee shop. You know, you've got to be enough people that will pay for what you have. And I think that's some place that people get a little too far down the road sometimes, before they realize that there's not enough people that are going to pay for it, no matter how good of a product or service they have.
You are so right on that one. Given your experience, do you think it's easier today to start a small business than it was 10 years ago?
Well, I think that it's a double-edged sword. You know, certainly from the time that I started my company till now, how you get going is very different. The double-edged sword is that it's so much easier to reach people. It's so much more inexpensive to reach people through social media channels and through, whether it's your website or email or whatever. You know, it's so much easier to get in front of your potential customer that you can start up a lot more inexpensively than companies were able to do 10 years ago. The flip side of that is, because it's so easy, there's a whole lot more competition out there and a whole lot more people trying to do something. So you've really got to differentiate yourself. You've got to be able to very quickly, because of everybody's short attention span, show somebody why your product is worth them spending 30 seconds trying to understand it. And so you've really got to be able to take advantage of those things that are so inexpensive to do, but that's so much more of a cluttered space. You've really got to have a strong message that resonates in a very short period of time. Otherwise, you're just more chatter.
Jeff, one last question. Well, one last question, which is, what do you think makes up a good entrepreneurial person?
What I think makes up a good entrepreneurial person? Well, you've got to have a free-spirited mind. I got out of the corporate world because I don't like being told what to do. That's definitely a strong point, but it's not such a strong point if you're not listening to your customers. But I think that the thing you have to do, I think the thing that, you know, has always been made good entrepreneurs very successful is that you can adjust to your game plan based on changes in the environment. So a lot of people come up with a meticulous plan and they plan out their next 5 years, and the world doesn't work like that. You know, something can happen in 3 months that could be a great revenue opportunity, and if you're so focused on what your original plan was, you miss that. You've got to be able to roll with the punches and change your direction based on what happens in the environment, and that's, for me, like, not knowing what's coming next is the most fun part about it. You know, I think the uncertainty is what really makes it exciting, because I know there'll be opportunities for something to capitalize on that I haven't thought of yet. But there's a lot of people that can't live like that. They want a plan all laid out, and they want to know what they're doing for the next 5 years. And those people aren't set out to be good entrepreneurs, I don't think. But if you're able to embrace the excitement of not knowing what comes next, that's what really makes a good entrepreneur.
We've been talking with Jeff O'Hara. Jeff, your website and your book and how people can reach you.
The website is www.nolameetings.com, and the book website is www.jeffreyohara.com, and people can always reach out to me on LinkedIn as well.
Well, a link to your website, a link for your websites will be on recalculating.biz tonight, where you can hear this and every other past and future program. And you can tell us, guess you like Jeff O'Hara, you'd like to hear. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us. It's been illuminating. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to speak with you, and thanks very much for helping me get out the message.
Jeff, have a great day.
Thank you. Have a wonderful week.
Wine, the Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveling. Recall, his mother, actually, Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with a mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. My name is Don Mazzella. We really have a very interesting guest today, Regis Malloy. He has what I consider. How you doing, Regis?
Good, thanks.
What I consider. Boy, we're stepping all over each other. That's okay, because you're going to do most of the talking this afternoon anyway. But anyway, Regis has a very unusual company, and we're going to ask him first to tell us a little bit about his, what I think is a very interesting background. Then tell us a little bit about his company, and then finally a website, because I know you'll want to know about that as well. Regis, welcome again to the program, and a little bit of your background.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Don. Thanks for having me. And as you mentioned, my name is Regis Malloy, and I'm the founder of a company called Give, and I'll talk a bit more about that in a second. As a background, my experience has been in the technology field, primarily in software. And not too long ago, I decided to take the leap and pursue an idea that I had that would help small businesses align with nonprofits and support great causes and connect with their customers and support their community. And so we started working on Give, and like any small business, we've had it's been an interesting and wild and woolly path where our initial business model changed over time, but ultimately led us to where we are today. And Give as an offering, it's a new service that makes it easy for small businesses to support their favorite nonprofits, and then we provide them with tools that they can use to inform their customers and their communities about their giving. We're integrated into accounting systems, first and foremost into QuickBooks, which is the leading accounting software system that's used by small businesses in the United States. And by integrating into QuickBooks, it's enabled us to deliver our business model where a business can give a percentage of their monthly revenue to their favorite nonprofits. At first, we considered, should a business simply be able to give a portion of their profits or maybe a portion, some proceeds of a particular product and so forth. But intuitively, we realized that consumers benefit from having a business give a percentage of their revenue because they can understand that. They usually don't have the data points to know what a percentage of profit works out to be or proceeds from a particular product and so forth. But in order for us to enable businesses to give a percentage of their revenue, we had to have access to that information. And fortunately, Intuit, which owns QuickBooks, has this wonderful development community which enables software developers like us to integrate into their system so that their businesses, the small businesses who use QuickBooks, can do just that. They can give a percentage of their monthly revenue to their favorite nonprofits. And because we've built our solution inside or on top of the Intuit ecosystem, it's all very secure, it's centralized, it's easy, it's automatic, and so forth. So it's been a great journey, and that's what's gotten us to where we are today.
Well, I have a lot of questions, but first, your website, because you have a very interesting company name.
Yes. So our company name is Give, and we spell that almost like the normal word give, but instead of an I, we use a numeric 1. So our company is spelled G1VE, and our website is www.give.org, again, G1VE. And the reason that that's our name is because our system enables businesses to give a percentage of their revenue to nonprofits, and most give 1%. So that's why we use 1 in our name. G1VE, Give.
Now let's back up a couple of steps because you've opened a lot of interesting roads that I'd like to explore. Number one, you said that you evolved. Can you give us kind of a roadmap of how your company evolved to where it is now?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think like a lot of small businesses. We started out with this vision and with this idea, and in our case, we all along our intent was to make it easy and rewarding for small businesses to support nonprofits. And the original idea that we had was more of a mobile app, and when consumers patronize businesses, then part of, for example, some of the advertising that businesses could do on our platform to those customers would go to their charities of choice. But that had a lot of moving parts, and pretty quickly into our development, we realized that that was a very difficult model. And so, like a lot of small businesses, right, we kind of the lean startup methodology, we pivoted, and we tried to strip away till we got to really what was the essence of what we were trying to accomplish. And as I was mentioning before, we realized that in order to deliver on our model of having a business being able to give a percentage of revenue to their favorite nonprofits, we began looking at accounting systems and ways to integrate into them, and very quickly realized that Intuit was just this wonderful opportunity because of the development platform that they had created where they open up their systems to developers like us. And so we began developing in earnest. And Give has only launched as a company. We're still in startup mode, you could say. We went through a pretty involved beta process with a handful of Intrepid beta customers, and we officially launched just this fall in August. And lo and behold, Intuit every year holds a global, what they call an app showdown, where all of the new apps, as they refer to them, who integrate into the Intuit ecosystem can participate in this competition. So I think there were about 120 eligible participants across the globe, and Give was fortunate enough to make the top 10 and head to QuickBooks' annual conference, QuickBooks Connect, which was in November in San Jose, where we pitched in kind of a Shark Tank-style presentation to an independent panel of judges in front of a large audience. And we, fortunately, we won. We were the winner of Intuit's 2018 App Showdown, which was really exciting. And the very next day, the CEO of Intuit presented us with a giant check and $100,000, and Intuit's helping us with marketing and PR and so forth, and helping us expand our offering to the QuickBooks community in the year ahead. So it's really been exciting, and we've been humbled and honored to be a part of it, but it's helping us deliver on our goal of enabling small businesses to give back.
Okay, now let's go into what you do. So let me see if I understand. You, in effect, are integrated into a small business's accounting and background, which is Intuit, so that you can identify for them what a percentage of their income, part of that their income is eligible to be donated, and then to identify the 1% that should be donated. Am I hearing that correctly?
Yes. So basically, any business in the United States who uses QuickBooks as their accounting system can use Give, and they can choose what percentage of their monthly revenue they'd like to give to their favorite nonprofits. And as we talked about before, most of them choose 1%, which led to our name, G1VE Give. And so from Give, they actually log in with their secure credentials that they use for QuickBooks. And then from there, they choose the percentage of revenue that they'd like to give. It doesn't have to be 1%. It can be more than that. It can be less than that. And then they choose from our portfolio of nonprofits, they choose their favorites. And then further, they choose how much of that percentage of revenue they would like to have go to each of those nonprofits. So, for example, a business may join and say, I'd like to give 1% of my revenue, and they may choose a portfolio of, five, six, seven, you name it, number of nonprofits, and they may say, I'd like 40% of that 1% to go to nonprofit number one, and 30% to go to the second nonprofit, and 20% to the third nonprofit, and so forth. So they essentially are creating kind of a giving portfolio. Or if they'd rather not pick from our selection of nonprofits, they can also choose a preset bundle. So we have a number of bundles of nonprofits. For example, we have one for children's well-being that includes Ronald McDonald House, St. Jude's Hospital, Make-A-Wish Foundation, Asperger Autism Network, and so on. All these great nonprofits that are focused on causes around children's well-being. So a business can simply choose one of those bundles. And then they're off to the races. They're basically done. They can set it and forget it, so to speak, and then Give does the rest. We calculate and we collect and then we distribute their monthly donations each month. We provide them with consolidated reports, information for tax time, and then we also provide every business who joins Give with a customizable profile page, a public profile page, where they can highlight what their business is and what they do, and then which nonprofits they support and so on. And they can link to that from their own website. They can share it in their own communications to their customers, whether it's email newsletters or social media and so forth, so that consumers are aware about their giving back. And the reason why that is so important is that right now, every year, consumers more and more show that they want to support social enterprises, that they want to support businesses who give back. There's a recent survey that just came out that showed that number to be over 70% of consumers want to know and support social enterprises. So it's good for businesses to do this. And we're at an interesting time right now where a lot of businesses are. For example, we're seeing large businesses and small that want to give back. They obviously want to be successful businesses, but they also want to give back and support their communities, and consumers are interested in it. And today, a lot of larger businesses are very good. They understand that, and they have the tools to communicate that and have a giving strategy and message it to their communities. Smaller businesses sometimes don't have that. They sometimes, you know, they wear a lot of hats. They're busy running their business, and they don't necessarily have the teams and the tools or the infrastructure or the bandwidth to have a giving strategy and to share that with their customers and communities. So that's really the purpose of Give, is to help illuminate what they're doing to their customers and communities who want to know, especially because small businesses, as you know, they're the lifeblood of our economy, and so we want to help them benefit from some of the same kinds of tools that large companies use, because they're so ideally situated to be the social enterprise that consumers want them to be.
We're talking with Regis Malloy. His company is give.org. Regis, your website?
Yes, that's correct, Don. The company name is Give, and the website is www.give.org, and Give is spelled G, numeric 1, V-E.
Okay, now, Regis, let me ask you this question. Number one, why are you an org? It's very, you're a nonprofit?
We are a public benefit corporation. If you're familiar with those, they sort of sit between for-profit and nonprofit corporations, but our whole mission, and to be a public benefit corporation, when you register with the state, part of our charter has to include a mission. Ours is to enable small businesses to support nonprofits. And so everything that we do is nonprofit related, really. We are serving as a clearinghouse for small businesses who are choosing that portfolio of nonprofits. And then each month we're distributing their donations to the nonprofits, and so for that reason, we have the org domain.
Okay, now let me ask you this: Do you help the company, the small business, publicize that they're providing this social benefit, or I don't understand what else you do? I assume the small business logs in, tells you how much they want to provide, or do you go in and log in to their system? How does it work?
So they log in, and then they choose the percentage that they want to give and which nonprofits they want to support. And again, they can choose a bundle of ours, or they can choose all of their own nonprofits. And then they can set it and go about their business. And then each month, through our integration, our system calculates what their monthly donation amount is and how much of it should go to each of the nonprofits that they've selected. And then we distribute that out to the nonprofits. And then we provide reports back to the business that they can access securely online through our system, and information for tax time, which makes it easier for accountants, helps make tax time a breeze, because now instead of a business potentially logging into multiple websites to donate to multiple nonprofits, everything is now secure and it's centralized and it's streamlined, and we can share that information with their accountants or they can. And then to your question, the way in which we help them is that we also create this customizable social profile page where they can show what nonprofits they're supporting, what their business does, where they're located, and so on. And then they can share that in their own social media and emailing and marketing campaigns and link to it on their own website so the consumers are aware of their giving back. Today, all of us see wonderful commercials and so forth of a lot of companies who do give back. But for a lot of smaller businesses, oftentimes their giving can be invisible, And sometimes they want it that way, which is totally, that's absolutely okay. We think they would still benefit from using a system like Give because of the fact that we automate it and streamline it and provide them with a centralized location to choose through a whole portfolio of nonprofits. But for those of them that do want to share that with their communities, especially in light of the fact that consumers increasingly want to know about it, we're providing them with a mechanism to do so. That giving is no longer invisible. It's now highlighted, and it's highlighted by a third party that is objectively managing and verifying their giving. So there's no gray area, I guess, as to whether or not that business is a social enterprise, which is good for them and good for their consumers.
Well, I agree with you. It's terrific. That's why you're on the program. But I don't understand one thing. Do you reach in because you're connected with Intuit, so you can reach in literally and look at their system yourself, or do they have to tell you how much they want to donate?
So they first and foremost authorize us to look at their system just simply to calculate what their monthly donation amount is based on their monthly revenue. And then they have total, they do everything else. They set up how much, what percentage they'd like to give, which nonprofits they'd like to give to, how much of that overall percentage should go to each of those nonprofits. And then they have total flexibility throughout the month. They can increase or decrease their overall percentage amount. So at the holidays, for example, they may increase from 1% to 2%, and they may say, I want that additional amount to go to these specific nonprofits. Or they can decrease. Maybe they know that seasonally they have a difficult time coming up, and so they can decrease, or they can pause at any month. So they've got total flexibility, and businesses have told us that that's one of the things that they're attracted to about using Give, particularly businesses who in the past have told us that they either avoided or delayed giving. Now they love using Give because of the flexibility that it's always a cash flow friendly percentage that they can control, that they can adjust. And even once they set it, if they meet a new nonprofit in their community or what have you that they want to support, they don't have to just physically cut a paper check to that nonprofit as they may have done in the past, which might have been something they haven't budgeted for. They can still maintain the exact same percentage that they're giving, but they can simply add that new nonprofit into their portfolio. And so they're still giving the same overall amount. It's still cash flow friendly. It's still in their budget, but now there's just more slices of the same pie helping more great causes.
Yes, I understand that. I guess what I'm hearing is many small businesses are worried that too many people can reach into them, but what they're doing in effect is allowing you to reach into their business and look at their numbers. If I hear you correctly,
it's machine to machine. It's a automated system process that occurs, and it's very tightly controlled what information we're allowed to see, and they have total control over that, over what information, if any, is shared. It's much like how today many small businesses enable their accountants and their bookkeepers and so forth to participate in their system. Give is simply looking at one tiny little bit of data, and it's system to system, and it's controlled and secure each month so that we can facilitate the monthly donation that they're looking to give.
But what's critical is that you have the approval and the support of Intuit in doing all of this, if I heard you correctly.
Yes, absolutely. So Intuit has a wonderful developer platform that enables small business software developers like us to integrate into their system, and it's all very, very controlled and rigorous. There's a lot of security and technology protocols that are involved, so it is wonderful, and it is very secure. It's secure for the business and so forth.
Well, how do you decide which charities are in these piles?
So we began with a few dozen very well-known national and even global nonprofits, and we have begun adding many more nonprofits to Give, many that are regional or perhaps local, and we've had a great deal of interest from nonprofits to be a part of Give. And the criteria for a nonprofit to be a part of Give is they have to be an accredited 501c3 that's in good standing. And what we do is any nonprofit can self-register from our website. Any small business can recommend a nonprofit to us from our website, and then we can contact them and activate them. And we're yet another mechanism for nonprofits to reach folks who support them and support what they're doing. There's no fee to the nonprofits. They enjoy that it's a recurring donation model, which is better for nonprofits. Nonprofits tend to receive donations in sort of a kind of a sporadic or lumpy manner throughout the year. And this just helps them when they're receiving a recurring donation amount, because it helps them with budgeting and with forecasting and so forth. And it opens up a new group of supporters to them in terms of small businesses that are in their communities and have a vested interest, as they do, a shared interest in supporting the mission that the nonprofit is pursuing. So any nonprofit that is a 501c3 in the United States can be a part of Give.
Well, you know, I'm on the board of the National Robotics Education Foundation, and you can rest assured tomorrow morning I'm going to sign up for your service.
That would be great. I might beat you to the punch, Don, but yes, please do.
We do our work nationally, but anyway, I'm sitting here a little flabbergasted because having worked with this particular charity for 8 years, finding local and national donors has always been the number one issue. We can always find ways to spend it, but we can never find enough ways to raise the money.
Right.
And small businesses. We have just a few minutes left, and you've done such a great job. What are you going to do? What are your plans for the future?
Sure. And before I touch on that, if I could, I'll just add on to your comment about some of the challenges that nonprofits have in fundraising. At a macro level, nonprofits in the United States spend about $29 billion, billion with a B, on fundraising. And that, of course, it's important for them to find supporters and folks who support their cause. What we're trying to do with Give is flip that or turn that flow around a little bit by pushing donations from small businesses to nonprofits. Those nonprofits then don't have to spend on fundraising to those businesses. They can spend those funds elsewhere within their organization and on their mission cause, which is ultimately what everyone cares about. And, for example, with National Robotics, certainly there are people all across the country who care about what your nonprofit is doing, and so they don't have to be simply in your backyard. They can be anywhere in the country, and they can add it to their portfolio through Give and support you. So it's really a win-win-win, we think, because consumers want to know about it, and so we're providing that third-party objective verified information that a business can share with their consumers and their communities. Businesses benefit from it because it's secure and it's automated and it's flexible and they have total control over it. And then nonprofits benefit from it because it's a new way for them to engage with supporters of theirs. And businesses, it helps strengthen their brand and helps align them with their community. And so for us, going forward to your question, we're very excited. We're very excited about what is ahead for us, and we're busy on developing new features and reaching out to more and more businesses who use QuickBooks to interest them in Give and bring them on board, because we think it's a win-win-win. And even for, you know, small businesses, you know, even if we just encourage them to give back as part of their business, whether they use a tool like Give or not, just because it's so helpful to the community.
Regis, tell us once again your website for our audience.
Sure. So again, my name is Regis Malloy, and our company is Give, and our website is www.give.org, and that is spelled G numeric 1 V-E, give.org, G numeric 1 V-E.org.
Thank you, Regis. Thank you so much.
You're doing
a great job. Something really necessary. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you today. Take care.
You too. And Regis, I will sign up the NREF tomorrow. Can't do
Wonderful.
It today, but okay. And perhaps we'll talk sometime soon. Thank
Wonderful.
You.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Wine and Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. For family, long a center of his life was unraveling. Recall, his mother, Tony Soprano's mother, ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with the mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. You have been listening to Small Business Digest. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. Go there to hear this and all past and future shows. And tell us of a guest you would like to hear on this program. Remember, this show is about helping our audience improve profit. I'm Don Mazzella, and thank you.